So this will be a general talk about M theory and some of the things that those of us in our workshop are working on. It'll be very general, and there will be some overlap with the last talk because I figured there'd be some overlap or some turnover in the participants. And I'm going to try and go slowly, so please do stop me with questions as you have them. So just to start very generally for a second, as you know, the standard model of elementary particles describes particle physics up to about, well, just below a TeV scale in energy as it's been measured thus far, by a model in which forces between particles like leptons and quarks arise through exchange of what are called gauge bosons, things like the photon and electroweak force-carrying particles called the W and the Z, and the gluons of quantum chromodynamics, which we can describe using a quantum mechanical perturbation expansion governed by a parameter describing the strength of interaction of a given force, which I can denote by some parameter G for the coupling constant or coupling strength between the matter particles and the force-carrying gauge bosons that introduce interactions between them. As far as gravity goes, we know that Einstein's theory of general relativity at the classical level also describes the force between massive bodies through exchange, if you like, of a force-carrying particle of spin 2 known as a graviton, with, in this case, an interaction strength that's given by the square root of Newton's constant, which in units where I take h bar and the speed of light to be 1, scales like a length or like the inverse of a mass parameter. So I'll call it 1 over m sub p for 1 over the, let's call it the Planck mass, which takes a value of about 10 to the 19th GeV. The fact that this coupling strength, in the case of gravity, has units of length means that quantum mechanically, if you think about a probability amplitude for a scattering process involving two masses in this theory, you see that in general terms, it will be governed by an effective interaction strength that grows with the energy or mass, if you like, of the particles which are participating in the process. So the effective coupling which is this energy scale divided by the Planck mass grows with energy. So as you go up in energy, the effective strength of the interaction increases, which means that if you try and extrapolate this perturbative quantum mechanics discussion to arbitrarily high energies in the case of gravity, you fail. And you need some different description of the system. This is one way in which gravity that's difficult at higher energies. And in fact, there are more basic reasons to believe that gravity behaves differently from other quantum mechanical systems at high energies. So, in ordinary quantum mechanics, we know Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which says that if we want to measure something at high energies, or if we go to high energies, we can probe distance scales, which are shorter and shorter. Which, you know, you can understand from the fact that wavelengths needed to probe shorter distances have higher frequency. But this relation is not true in gravity at the highest energies. Which you can see from the presence of what are known as black hole systems in gravity. So, as I'm sure you're all familiar, but at least at a colloquial level, there are solutions of Einstein's theory of gravity, which describe the curvature of space resulting from a matter source, say in a spherically symmetric distribution, which has an event horizon at some radius r, which grows like Newton's constant times the mass of the source of stress energy that you introduce into the system. Yes, we are in four dimensions here so far.
You talk to biologists.
No, it's of course an important question. But for now, let me be in four dimensions. And this event horizon has a property that particles can go in, but they can't come out because of the dramatic, because of the way the space-time geometry works and the way the light cones behave going across this event horizon. So, in this system, you see that the simple fact that's been emphasized by many people in our field, that as you increase the mass, you increase the size, rather than having this inverse relation familiar from ordinary quantum mechanics or ordinary quantum field theory. And to prepare for some comments I'll make later about recent results in string theory, I want to now mention another simple property of black hole physics, which is the following thing. So if we, again, look at this classical gravity theory of Einstein's and analyze the dynamics of this kind of black hole system, what you find is that the area of the black hole horizon, which goes like this radius squared, always increases or never decreases. And in fact, the way it increases is related to the way the mass of the black hole increases. By this relation, plus other terms that involve possible angular momentum or electric charges and so on that the black hole may carry. The surface gravity that I've introduced here as a coefficient in this relation between the change in the mass and the change of the area of the black hole is known as the surface gravity. It's basically the force needed to hold a particle up at the event horizon. Now, this equation might look familiar, particularly if I add the other terms involving, for example, angular momentum. And indeed, there was noticed an analogy between this these facts, in particular this equation, and ordinary thermodynamics, in which we have the non-decreasing entropy and an energy conservation equation. Which is known as the first law of thermodynamics and takes this form here. So there was noticed an evident analogy between these two sets of equations, and there was an obvious question as to whether there's a statistical mechanical description of the black hole system to go along with this large-scale thermodynamic pattern of expressed by these equations. So one of the questions that string theory has answered lately is the question of, is there a statistical mechanics that let's say reproduces this thermodynamic, the set of thermodynamic relations. And at the quantum mechanical level, of course, this idea is very much bolstered by Hawking's calculation of radiation from the black hole. So in a kind of semi-classical analysis, Hawking showed that indeed the black hole radiates at a temperature which is given by this surface gravity quantity that I defined here. I'll come back to this later after I've introduced the brains of string theory, which will give a modern perspective on this and will indeed allow us to construct a statistical description of this system. Are there any questions?
So does it radiate with the same step on Boltzmann constant as one of the feet of the fourth?
It's the usual statistical. So the part of the issue is where the information about precisely what went in goes, given that it comes out in a completely thermal distribution according to this calculation. There are subtleties. Are there any other questions?
So the question was about the constant up front.
Because
you had to define what you meant by the entropy, and that requires a constant in front of the area. You could have S is equal to an arbitrary constant.
I meant in front of the T to the fourth and the radiation.
It goes like more or less like the Boltzmann bound. So the area of the horizon tends to the fourth. It's the rate of mass loss.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So I'm going to come back to this, but in the spirit of motivating some of the basic features of gravity that distinguish it from the other forces, let me give a third and final hint that gravity behaves differently at high energies than the other forces. And this is another problem of great interest in our field. So another possible hint that high energies might be related to long distances rather than short distances is a puzzle in our field, which is known as the cosmological constant problem. So in Einstein's theory of gravity, at the classical level, again, one has an equation which relates the stress energy source that might be present in a space-time to the curvature that it induces in a self-consistent way. And there's a possibility for an overall background energy density to be present, which I've separated out into this cosmological constant term, lambda.
G-mean
you're
multiplying, otherwise the tensor
structure. Of course. So this is a background energy everywhere in space whose stress energy tensor is proportional to the metric. Now, so we get this equation for the curvature of space in response to matter and energy sources. And this raises a puzzle as to why we see such large, almost flat dimensions astronomically. So observationally, we know that this cosmological term is of the order of an inverse millimeter to the fourth, or in sort of particle physics units, 10 to the minus 12 electron volts to the fourth. And in fact, recent observations suggest that it saturates this, what used to be this upper bound. However, if we extrapolate particle physics up to even to high energies and even to the energies we've seen, we get the wrong answer for this quantity. So if we add up the vacuum energy, the zero point energies from all the modes of all the particles and fields at low energies that we know exist in the standard model, then at best, we get a prediction for the cosmological constant, which goes like, again, in four dimensions, four powers of the maximal scale, which I'll call M sub UV, up to which we trust our calculation. So even if we cut this off at the electroweak scale, or even at the QCD scale, we get an answer which is much, much bigger than the observed value. So we have a big puzzle in any theory of gravity to understand why we see four large dimensions. Although in most areas we're kind of waiting for experimental input, this is one place where theory is well behind experiment. Are there any questions about this? Okay, so finally, let me get to string theory, which realizes some of the features of gravity that we've anticipated. In particular, it has different behavior at high energy than field theory. It can account for black hole entropy, and there are many other interesting features of the theory that I'll try, some of which I'll try to discuss. Okay, so string theory began as, at least in terms of the theory of gravity, as a simple way of getting around this problem of short distance singularities in the quantum mechanical perturbation analysis that I was alluding to at the beginning, by the simple trick of replacing particles by strings, so that this diagram I wrote down involving short distance features which can lead to these kinds of singularities, are manifestly absent. So one draws a similar diagram depicting forces between strings which have no short distance features to lead to singularities. And again, in this description, one has a parameter describing the interaction strengths of strings, which I'll call the string coupling, G sub S. There's also, in this proposal, a parameter L sub S, which is the typical length scale of the string, otherwise known as 1 over the square root of its tension, which in the simplest cases is about the scale of inverse Planck scale, or depending on the value of the string coupling, can be a bit longer. Okay, so this is a perturbative description. It's a generalization of this quantum mechanical perturbation theory to this situation where one doesn't have short distance singularities. And it turns out that the string coupling that describes the interaction strengths in this string context is dynamical. So we can't choose what it is, and we have to think about what happens as a function of the coupling strength of the string. And one can imagine, therefore, going away from this limit and asking, what fundamental theory might reduce to this perturbative description as we take G string to become small? So this is fundamentally perturbative. It's as if when we're doing quantum mechanics with the perturbation expansion and no underlying Hamiltonian. And one of the big questions in our field is, what is the underlying theory, which reduces to this as the coupling strength of the string is taken to become very small? This question is not answered in general, but there are some partial answers in different systems. And one way that turned out to be fruitful to begin to ask this question about how strings behave when they begin to interact more strongly is to begin by thinking about what's going on at strong coupling, but confining ourselves to low energies. And for this, a very important ingredient known as D-brains will help us unearth the physics in this regime, as well as in other regimes. So in extrapolating from particles to strings, you notice I drew this diagram with closed loops of strings. But there's not really any reason I had to do that. I can consider, in addition, adding open strings, so strings that don't close on themselves. And then there's a question of what their boundary conditions are, what the boundary conditions are at the ends of the strings. So we can choose free boundary conditions or fixed boundary conditions or something which interpolates between them. For each of the dimensions in which the theory lives, and it turns out, as Steve mentioned last time, that string theory starts out living in 10 dimensions. So if we consider, say, a case where we have Dirichlet boundary conditions, fixed boundary conditions in some directions, and free boundary conditions in other directions for the open strings, then one gets a preferred locus in space-time where the open strings have their endpoints. And in the free directions, they move along a hyperplane whose dimension depends on how many dimensions we took to have free boundary conditions. So when this led to the idea of an object, a locus in space-time where open strings can have their endpoints, and then these open strings can interact with the closed strings that live everywhere in the space-time to give a consistent open plus closed string theory. Moreover, these objects have non-trivial dynamics in and of themselves. If you calculate the tension by asking how this object contributes to the source term on the right-hand side of Einstein's equations, how this object curves space, you can calculate its tension, and you find that it is proportional to the inverse of the string coupling. So in this limit where we took G string to be very small, these objects are very heavy, that this gives us a clue as to what might happen when we do try and take the string coupling to become large, and perhaps infinitely large. In this limit, from this expression, the tension of these objects, and if you consider small curved up versions of these objects, their mass, goes to zero as we take the strong coupling limit of the original, of the interacting strings living in the bulk and on the world volumes of these objects. So as the string coupling gets large, these D-brains become light and begin to dominate the low-energy physics. So one has a situation where, as we crank up the string coupling G-string, for small G-string, we have this theory of interacting closed string described well by this perturbation expansion, which is completely sensible at short distances. And then, as we crank up the coupling, these D-brain objects can become light. And if you consider a one-dimensional version, for example, you find that you can have one of these one-dimensional D-brains or D-strings come down and dominate the physics at low energy as you take D-string to infinity. And the perturbation expansion describing the interactions of these D-strings is simply another weakly coupled string theory. So this is one thing that can happen, which I've tried to motivate for you from the non-perturbative formula for the mass of these, or tension of these objects. So we start off with our quantum mechanical perturbation theory. We crank up the string coupling, and we find that a new weakly coupled string theory takes over, described by, if you like, quasi-particles of the original string theory given by these D-brains, which now have become light in this limit. This is just one example of the sort of thing that can happen. But I hope this gives you a flavor for this kind of answer to this question of what happens as you take the string coupling to become large in string theory. Are there any questions about this phenomenon?
Yes, what is a brain? I mean, isn't the solid term of a string theory just a...
So you can also think of it...
Why you wanted to have it, but not what it is.
I'm sorry?
You said what you wanted to get, but you didn't say what these brains were.
Well, one answer to that question is what I said. It's this object on which the open strings can end, whose mass is given by this formula, which has electric charges and so on. And there's another description, which will indeed become important, in which this object can be thought of as itself a solution of the stringy versions of Einstein's equations, so more like a soliton. However, its dependence on the string coupling, it is much different from an ordinary quantum field theoretic soliton that you might be used to. Its tension only grows like one power of the inverse coupling rather than two. And that's one of the interesting features of these objects. That has the effect of, well, that's part of what gives this nice, simple, open string description of the dynamics of these objects, because if you think about if you think about Einstein's equations, and I tell you a little bit more about the string coupling, the string coupling in particular tells us the coupling between gravitons and matter fields in our theory, and in particular, one finds that Newton's constant goes like the square of the string coupling. So over here in string theory, we should put L string squared times G string squared in for Newton's constant in four dimensions. I just told you that the tension, the stress energy of this brain goes like one inverse power of G string with this string length L string making up the dimensions. And so as you see that from this, these two factors, as you take G string to zero and go to this perturbative description, you find that the effects of this D-brain object on the space-time curvature indeed goes to zero. So this description in terms of a flat brain where open strings can end is accurate. So the answer I gave you of describing things in terms of these open strings interacting with closed strings and ending on this hyperplane in space-time is completely consistent given this expression for the tension. However, it turns out that if I take a large number of these objects, then if I scale the number of these objects to be large enough, then I can turn on the stress energy source to get a large enough contribution that you do get space-time curvature. And that will be important in answering your question in a different regime.
Can you just say, to answer that question, that well, string theory has a bunch of charge, basically gauge fields, and you can ask, well, what's the object naturally charged under them? And you see things, and they have to exist because you have to pair. You can, if you imagine, you can pair create things that carries charge under all the gauge fields in the theory. What do you guys know about?
Okay, I mean, they're also sources of gravity, but
among other things, it's charged.
It's true. These are also sources for some. They're like electrons in some sense. They're charged under.
That doesn't necessarily follow. There isn't a rule for pair creating monopoles in QED.
No, but the question was, you know, how do you physically think of these things? And one natural way to think about it is we postulate the fact that these gauge fields exist when we write down string theory. These are more and more gauge fields. What's charged under them? Well, if you think about this kind of stuff, it's a natural way to physically motivate why it should be part of theory. I think that's the level of questions being asked.
Oh, another thing you can say is that there are solutions of the string equations in motion because Euclidean boundary conditions preserve conformal invariance on the world sheet.
Who knows what conformal invariance is in this?
The energy doesn't flow out of the endpoint.
Right. So these are good solutions of the theory. And there's an important sense in which they themselves can be thought of as solutions of the field equations of the theory, which include these photon fields and so on that Aki was mentioning. I may get to that.
So
Yeah.
One more question. So I thought one of the points of string theory was that you didn't need an arbitrary coupling constant.
Right, so this is, as I mentioned, this is dynamical.
Right, so does that mean it, that it really depends only on LS or where?
Right, which is, it's a dimensionful thing, so it just gives us a reference scale with respect to which we measure everything else. I'm going to get now to one issue that this raises, which is what is the value of this? What it starts out looking like is an arbitrary vacuum expectation value for a scalar field. And so one of the problems is to understand what determines those vacuum expectation values, which would tell us, ultimately, once we have a realistic background, what the fine structure constant is, and so on. We're not nearly there yet, but one of the things that people in the workshop are making progress on is that sort of question. So let me, again, just to give you an idea, briefly mention that issue in slightly more generality and then mention some of the ideas people are playing with. So, as I mentioned, the theory makes a prediction for the largest number of flat dimensions we can live in, and then that number turns out to be, 10 in this perturbative limit and 11 if we allow these limits where we take the string coupling to be large. So that raises the question of how do we get precisely 4 large dimensions? Now, a generic background, as I argued before, would be highly curved in all dimensions. Even if we imagine that we've solved the problem of understanding why 4 dimensions and large, while the remaining 6 or 7 stay compact, there's a big question as to precisely how those compact dimensions look. So what I'm drawing here is a space-time background which breaks up into 4 essentially infinitely large non-compact dimensions and 7 dimensions which are curled up into some solution of Einstein's equations. So this is known as a compactification. And the topology of this space and its geometry determines the 4-dimensional particles and interactions that propagate on these large dimensions. Now, there are many, many, many choices at the classical level for these compact, the shape and size of these compact dimensions. In particular, there's a continuous set of choices coming from the possibility of changing the size and the shape of this compactification in a way that's consistent with solving Einstein's equations. So, changing the shape and size of this compact component, let me call it X7, gives us, in addition to this string coupling constant, a whole slew of spinless fields, scalar fields, whose vacuum expectation values need to be determined.
Why 7 additional dimensions?
Well, there's a large piece of the story which I hadn't mentioned yet, involving a kind of symmetry that seems intrinsic in this theory known as supersymmetry, which only makes sense in flat space up through 11 dimensions. And all of the string theories that were discovered had that symmetry microscopically, and live in 10 dimensions, and there's a way to get from the perturbative string theories in 10 dimensions to an 11-dimensional theory by considering a case where a Dirichlet particle becomes light in this kind of limit, and a Dirichlet particle in many bound states of it, which gives a consistent connection between those two statements. But I'm not going to be able to explain the details of that to you. Just you can think of it at least partially as a symmetry principle. Okay. So we have a bunch of these scalar fields, and if we're in this perturbative string limit, it includes this string coupling G string, but there are many others. And in addition, there seem to be this discrete, there seem to be this, these discrete choices of topology. And this includes, for example, the chirality of the particle spectrum, the net number of generations in four dimensions. So, in the same spirit as these kinds of connections that I was trying to explain to you over here, we found connections in string theory between different of these discrete choices by going through regions where the difference between string theory and particle theory makes a difference, so that a transition in which a particle observer on the space would have to see it break open in order to change its topology. The string, which is only sensitive to scales down to this L string, does not see any kind of singularity as one changes the topology. And in a quantum mechanical version of that, one can also see the chirality change. So there's been progress in understanding at least how to connect these different choices of compactifications. But this problem of understanding these continuous choices of shape and size of a given topology is one which is a perennial problem in string theory, but several groups at our workshop are making significant progress on this problem. So let me just give you a sense of what they're doing, because it's really quite simple. So there's a question of how you stabilize these many modes. So of course, quantum mechanically, one expects a potential energy to develop, which will depend in general on all these fields. And so the generic answer is that there will be a potential energy generated, and that potential will have minima at some points where these scalar fields will be fixed. But a way to really see it in a nice classical way is to use the possibility of contributions of magnetic fluxes to the scalar potential. So if you take, for example, a sphere, which might be part of such a compactification geometry, and you introduce a magnetic field on that sphere in such a way that the integral over the sphere of the B field, which is pointing outward uniformly around the sphere of radius r, is equal to some effective magnetic charge Q, so that the value of this magnetic field is Q divided by the radius squared of the sphere. Then you see that the energy, which goes like B squared, will go like Q squared over R to the fourth times R squared when integrated over the sphere. And so this energy, as a function of the radius of the sphere, gets smaller as you increase the radius. So if you consider one of these compactifications with a magnetic field threading a sphere of this sort, then you see that there is a potential energy generated, which drives the radius to larger values. If you introduce compensating contributions to the potential, such as a brain wrapping the cycle or wrapping the sphere, or other kinds of magnetic fluxes in different directions in the manifold, in the compactification, you can go a long way toward stabilizing all of these scalar fields, all of these size and shape deformations in the theory. So that's a subject of considerable interest in our workshop at this point. Is this clear? Are there any questions about this? Okay, then I'd like to get back to the subject of black holes using really just mentioning a result that came out of string theory using our new knowledge of the D-brain contribution to the spectrum. So, and this will go toward some of the other ways of describing the brains that people have brought up. So, going back to this black hole system, using these very heavy sources of stress energy in string theory, we can make large black holes and then study their properties using this open string description of the system. So when we do consider a large number of these objects, one finds that the gravitational fields determined by this background roughly looks like this, with a size that grows as the quantity n times g string grows, turns out to the 1/4 power. And by putting together appropriate combinations of D-brains, you can study this using the classical general relativistic analysis that I mentioned in terms of black holes earlier. And so using general relativity, you can measure the area of the black hole made up out of D-brains. The other thing you can do, however, is consider a limit where this quantity n times the number times the string coupling is small, at which point, as I was arguing to you before, you get this nice description in terms of open strings. This description allows you to calculate the entropy, which is the log of the number of states of the system as a function of the energy, and compare it to this area of the black hole in this regime. And given this particular symmetry, supersymmetry, you can argue that these two answers should agree, and in fact, they do. So one finds, with the right coefficient, that this entropy, calculated this way in terms of this open string description, gives the same answer as the area of the black hole horizon described in terms of the general relativistic description of the of this brain system. So one indeed finds a statistical interpretation of that thermodynamic relation. Now, one of the questions of interest at our workshop is how to generalize this kind of idea to time-dependent or cosmological space-times. And this is a very nascent subject, so I'll just, there are lots of interesting ideas around for this, and this is one of the things that people are doing. I won't say too much more about it than to state the question, though. So one of the issues that people are discussing is whether in cosmological space-times, with a cosmological horizon of some area, is there an entropy associated with that, and if so, can we account for it in a statistical way? Given this great success in the black hole case, one might hope to be able to extend it to concrete cosmological spaces, and people have made progress in understanding what this would mean in general terms in general relativity. But we're trying to construct examples of cosmological backgrounds in string theory that are completely microscopically consistent, which might allow one to come up with this side of the equation in this cosmological case. So the last thing that I'll probably be able to mention extends this relation that I was just motivating for you to a very non-trivial type of duality or equivalence that has been very well studied in recent years, which is known as the ADS-CFT correspondence. Which some of your questions, in fact, anticipated. So let's take our system of N D brains and indeed look at them in the two different ways we were discussing. One way of looking at them was via the open string description, which, as I explained, is most useful when the string coupling or the string coupling times the number of brains is small. And let's also look at low energies and see what happens to this system. Well, if we look just at the brains, we have these open string degrees of freedom. If we have n brains, you see there are n places that each endpoint can live. So in total, there are n squared possible open strings, which at low energy or long distance just look like ordinary particles or quantum fields. So we get a quantum field theory at low energies, which has some very particular properties that I won't have time to explain to you today. The other way of looking at it is indeed more in line with the soliton picture of brains, in which the object looks like some curved space-time. And so then you can ask, well, what is the analog in this description of going to low energies in this open string description? And one way to access that is to consider a probe brain and asking how much energy it needs to probe this system of N D brains. If it's far away, because the string stretching from it to this system of ND brains is long, the energy required will be greater than if it's close by and can probe it with a shorter string, because the energy of the string, of course, like an ordinary rubber band, grows like the tension times the distance, we call it rho, from the probe brain to the collection of N brains. So that suggests that in order to go to low energies, we just want to keep this region in the core of the solution, which is known as the near horizon region. So this same system, and this gets back to the question over there of how do you describe this brain or this set of brains, and in fact there are two equally good ways, which leads to a very non-trivial statement about the equivalence of these two descriptions. On the one hand, we have an ordinary particle physics model with, again, very specific properties that I can explain to you later if you're interested. On the other hand, you have this gravitational background, the limit of this gravitational background near its core, which is a full 10-dimensional string theory. Which turns out, as you say a little bit more about this background, to be a product of a five-dimensional sphere times a negatively curved space known as anti-de Sitter space. And the quantum field theory is an ordinary four-dimensional particle physics model. The fact that these two are equivalent allows us to say many things about both sides, both types of theories, and in particular allows us to answer this question of what a fundamental theory might be that reduces the perturbative string theory in the right limit by formulating it in this background the string theory instead in terms of the equivalent quantum field theory. And I am running out of time, but that is a very important development that many people are continuing to explore and to apply. So I think I have indeed run out of time, and so I should probably stop here. There's a lot more to say, and I'm sure we'll have many opportunities in future Blackboard talks to accommodate this.
Well, you don't have time for questions. It's a comment, actually. It's concerning the Zeltovich-like argument for the cosmological constant being non-vanishing in the standard model. I would say that there is an assumption made that the underlying theory is not conformal invariant. If the underlying theory is conformal invariant, then may that symmetry be spontaneously broken or not in a field theoretical constant, this argument would be invalid.
I think in a field theory, that just says it's either zero or infinity, since there's no scale, and it's just as likely to be infinity. And in fact, for a free field theory, it's infinity.
No, well.
I mean, you know, the fact that there's no scale doesn't mean it can't get generated.
Spontaneously broken, so it's spontaneous. It's true. And also, if it's true that when you have a spontaneous breaking, you generate a scale, but the vacuum energy is insensitive to that.
Because it's infinite.
Maybe we should ask for questions from the non-string.
are there any?
You made a side remark, and when you're talking about compactification, I'm not sure if I understood. You talked about different topologies, and if you have strings, there's no singularities when you change. So can you fluctuate among different topologies?
Well, that's an extremely interesting question. What was done so far is to just show that, the short answer is yeah. I mean, I think there's plenty of evidence that that's true. What was actually done was to consider the situation where four of the dimensions are non-compact, so that when you transition from one to the other, you're essentially going from between different super selection sectors in the theory, but in real life, these four dimensions are compact or are cosmological and might allow for dynamical changes of this sort. But the fact that it's smooth has definitely been established in a very concrete way. This is not just words in these cases.